This is The View from 22 from The Spectator. Subscribe from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk.
Welcome to The Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman, the assistant editor of The Spectator. This week, I'll be discussing deportation with Douglas Murray and Don Flynn, the director of the Migrants' Rights Network. James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson will consider whether Osborne can see off Boris. And Mick Hume from Spiked and Jack May, one of the founders of the Stepford Student website, will join me to discuss whether politically correct students are now falling victim to the censorious climate they helped create. First up, deportation. In this week's cover feature, Rod Little and Douglas Murray look at Britain and Europe's approach to deportation. In Britain, we can't get rid of jihadis, sex gang ringleaders and drug lords, so we try to deport old ladies, says Rod. In Europe, it's worse, says Douglas. Their attitude to migrants is suicidal. Thanks to Britain's geography and a few sensible decisions by our government, Britain has so far been spared the worst of the migrant crisis, he argues. But we should pity most of the other European countries because they are losing control, not just of their borders, but of their civilization and culture, the whole caboodle. I'm now joined by Douglas Murray and Don Flynn, the director of the Migrants' Rights Network, to discuss whether Britain and Europe have a serious problem on their hands. So Douglas, Rod says in his piece that the number of foreign criminals we manage to deport is going down year after year. But why is that?
Well, all sorts of things, of course. Partly as a problem within the system of Britain's own making, partly a problem not of Britain's own making, but of course of the making of the European Union, various European treaties that we're signed up to, various national and international agreements which we're part of, all of which, I think, as Rod stresses in his piece, make it essentially impossible to deport anyone for anything. He gives a number of blackly hilarious examples of people who Britain cannot apparently get rid of. Although he does mention, of course, that a 92-year-old widow called Myrtle seems to be in the Home Office's sights for immediate deportation.
And Don Flynn, you must be in favour of most of these agreements because they protect the people who you represent. Do you think there is a problem with some of them when it comes to foreign criminals rather than those who are here and haven't done anything wrong at all?
Well, you know, I think the first point to make is that Rod Little's piece is just completely and totally wrong on that. The Home Office obliges us by publishing statistics for the number of foreign offenders that it deports each year. We've had those figures since 2009. Last year it was 5,022 foreign offenders who were deported. And that's just about square in the middle. It fluctuates between low figures of 4,600 up to high figure of 5,600. We are continuing to deport as many foreign offenders as we ever have done.
But Richard Harrington has recently said that there are many, many more criminals who the government would like to deport but just cannot, so that there must be a problem, or do you disagree with that?
It's down for Richard Harrington to produce evidence of that. If the Home Office has got people that it wants to deport, then they'll be processing them. We'll see this in the statistics. I mean, I have to say, rather sceptical about politicians who feel they have to respond to the various constituencies that they're dealing with. I wonder whether some of these statements are more coloured by that rather than the solid evidence that we know exists.
Douglas, why do ministers seem so powerless? Surely the solution is for them to campaign for Britain to leave the European Union, or is it much more difficult than that?
Well, it is more complicated than that, but because, as I've said before, the fact is that the day after we would leave the European Union, we'd still see across the continent the whole range of challenges which we see currently, and we'd have domestically a whole set of challenges. I think there is a very good argument, though, that were we to leave, we would be able to be more in control, not only of our own borders, but of our own deportation policy. And we would be able to get out of some of the agreements that make the examples that Rod gives in his piece, I mean, the most ludicrous examples, moribund. It is a big problem, I would say, democratically, when a government is not able to get rid of people which it wants to get rid of and who the public want them to get rid of because of supra-governmental views. I think that's a massive problem. It's a sovereignty problem And it's obviously a problem which the public wants some kind of answer to. But as I say, that on its own, leaving the EU doesn't solve that. It would simply make us better able to react to these ongoing issues.
So, Don, do you think there is a democratic problem here?
I think to help democracy, it's always good if we have some reference point with the facts. And, you know, I think the assertions that we've had both in Rod Little's article and what Douglas has just said, that it's impossible to deport people, just doesn't stack up against the facts. The government, in the last year that we have complete figures for, the government deported 40,000 people. And, you know, it regularly does that year on and year out. The government has substantial powers for being able to get people out of the country that it doesn't want to be here. They often mess it up. They often get things completely wrong and assert incorrect facts during the course of that process. And there are circumstances where lawyers have to step in, and it sometimes leads to appeals and court cases and so on in order to correct these gross errors. But to assert that governments don't have the authority to deport people, you know, I mean, what's happened to these 40,000 people? Is that all a mistake?
Douglas, do you disagree with that?
Well, I do, firstly, because there are so many cases, in particular, notably the hard cases, which the government manifestly does fail on. And Rod gives a number of pertinent examples in his piece. I think, however, and I mean, the point of my piece alongside Rod's in this is to say how actually comparatively good we are at this in Britain, comparatively lucky we are compared to other members of the European Union at the moment. And you see, to my mind, the issue of criminals, people who actually have committed offences, for instance, and need to be deported and so on, is not the hard bit at all. It's the absolutely easiest part of the deportation issue. A much more important thing, which is now a very significant challenge across Europe, and I think could be yet the thing that brings down the European Union, is the fact that the numbers now on the continent of people who should not be in, for instance, Germany or Sweden, are so incredibly high that there is no way that the German, Swedish or any other government is going to deport them. And let me give you a quick example of this. You see, as I say, the criminal issue is a relatively easy one to deal with alongside this one. More important are the people who come in far larger numbers, who are economic migrants, who often falsely claim asylum, or who have in the last year entered Europe without any right to be here, but who have been welcomed effectively by European leaders like Angela Merkel. The numbers in the last year in particular have been so large that now, only now, this from the beginning of this year, have European politicians, like those figures from the European Commission and others, started to admit that they have a massive deportation issue on their hands. You know, you see, for instance, the Swedish government that took in 163,000 people last year now admits that of the people who came, perhaps 80,000 of them should not have come to Sweden. They are economic migrants, not criminals, and not asylum seekers, but economic migrants who should not be in Sweden. And the Swedish government, or some members of the Swedish government, are making these noises that they are going to deport these people. Now, I think we would all agree that's absolute nonsense, as it is in the case of Germany. A German government document suggests that up to 1.5 million people may have entered Germany last year. Now, in January of this year, Frans Timmermans of the European Commission admitted himself that perhaps 60% of the people who entered last year shouldn't be here because they are economic migrants and not asylum seekers, people with no right to claim asylum in the EU. Now, going on Frans Timmermans' figures, as I say in my piece, that means that just from people who arrived last year alone, Germany should currently be limbering up to deport about 750,000 people. Now, I come back to my point about the democratic mandate issue. This is a far bigger matter than deporting people because they are convicted criminals or anything else. This is about massive deportations from the continent of Europe. And the problem about this is that, as I say, everybody involved in this area knows that it is not going to happen. Sweden is not going to deport 80,000 people from last year alone. Germany is not going to be deporting 750,000 people. It isn't going to happen. And the consequence of that, among other things, is that more and more people come. This is a much bigger issue than the deportation of people who've been convicted of a crime in the UK. This is a massive civilizational issue, and one which I think has lamentably little attention paid to it.
And Don Flynn, do you agree that, as Douglas says in his piece, that Europe is on a suicide mission as a result of its approach to the migration crisis?
No, I certainly don't, and I don't think that Douglas has given us any evidence now. He's quoted this Swedish politician and that Belgian politician, and there's probably, you know, quite a few other politicians across Europe he could have quoted their opinions as well. And, you know, you can
these aren't opinions, Don. Let's just get this correct. This isn't opinion. This is the facts from the European Commission and the Swedish government, which I don't think we should ignore.
They're cited as maybes, possibles, perhaps. It's all speculation.
It's not speculation at all.
Well, Douglas, what we do know is that this what's currently going on, as far as Europe is concerned at the moment, is being driven by a major civil war right on the borders.
No, that's definitely a speculation and a wrong one.
Refugee movements that extend out into from Afghanistan into the Horn of Africa, right the way across North Africa. They are the facts, and we ought to be concentrating on that. That's the source of the current refugee movements.
This is a very interesting mistake you've just made. Firstly, we do actually know from the fact that the majority of people trying to come to Europe and the majority of people who came to Europe last year are not Syrian refugees. They are not fleeing civil war in Syria. They are people from across sub-Saharan Africa, North Africa, from the Middle East, and across as far away as Bangladesh. And the European Union's own figures bear that out. The European Commission's own analysis bears this out. This is the analysis of the Frontex border agencies, that the people who come are not in the main Syrian refugees. And you see, if I may say so, Don and others from his part of this argument massively damage their own case here. Because
Don, do you want to respond to that, Don?
If I may just finish this point. If you want to meld together a real humanitarian crisis in Syria, which none of us deny, and which in my own view does mean you need to give asylum to people genuinely fleeing civil war, it is imperative that you do not tie up that minority issue with the majority of people who have come to Europe in the last year, who, as I say, in the analysis of the European Commission itself, which is not an authority that I particularly care for, but it is an authority, should not be in Europe because they are not asylum seekers fleeing civil war. They are economic migrants. We should not meld those things together, because the one thing you can be certain of is that it'll mean down the line that public sympathy for people genuinely fleeing a civil war in Syria will decline.
Okay, Don Flynn, to finish, your response.
Well, and you know, again, there are a lot of assertions here. There's the European Commission says this and somebody else says that and so on. I mean, you know, people can Google all of this and check the facts themselves. The United Nations High Commission for Refugees says that 2/3 of the people who are moving across the Balkans at the moment are Syrian refugees. The second biggest group are Afghans, and that's supplemented by other
That's one single movement. You haven't even taken into account people entering from other parts of Europe. You haven't even taken into account, for instance, people entering from Italy.
Douglas, let's keep going with Don Flynn just to finish.
You referred to the 1.5 million people who entered and whose mode of entry has been attributed to the refugee movements across the Aegean and the adjacent area. If you want to talk about economic migration, I mean, you're absolutely right. That is a much bigger issue. You know, the UK is a country which moves 100 million people across its border every year, primarily for economic reasons. The whole debate about the fifth runway at Heathrow is about economic reasons for moving people across borders. But that is because Europe operates with a model of trade, commerce, and doing business in which its borders have to be permeable. It has to connect with the rest of the world. It has to open up channels where people can move and so on. And, you know, by and large, these produce positive outcomes. They produce economic growth. They produce a high standard of living. These are the issues that really ought to be constituting the debate about immigration policy, and not these assertions and claims and unsubstantiated allegations, which I'm afraid don't.
I would invite Don to visit any country across Central Europe or Northern Europe at the moment, or indeed across Southern Europe, and pretend that what I've just said are assertions. They are the facts on the ground, and I'm very sorry that Don and his colleagues want to ignore them.
Rhetoric and empty assertions. That's what it is.
That was Douglas Murray and Don Flynn. Migration and deportation is sure to be a large part of the EU debate in the coming months. But closer to home, there's another big battle looming, the Tory leadership contest. In his political column this week, James Forsyth says it would be rash and wrong to write off Osborne's chances of succeeding Cameron. If his side wins the referendum and the economy continues to outperform the rest of Europe, he will be a contender. I'm now joined by James and Fraser Nelson to discuss who might be shaping up to succeed Cameron. So, James, has George Osborne had a good time in terms of his leadership chances recently?
I think if you compare, when he stood up to deliver his last budget straight after the election, he was, I think, at the kind of height of his powers. You know, his economic strategy had been vindicated by the election result. His political strategy had been vindicated by the election result. He announced the national living wage. It's a kind of rapturous cheers on the Tory side. He appeared to have put, you know, and 2% of GDP on defence. He appeared to have put flesh on the bones of the idea of the Tories as the party of working people. A year on, you know, he's had to U-turn on his tax credit changes. He's had to abandon the pension tax relief changes he was intellectually certainly keen on. He's now on the other side to most Tory activists on the big issue of the day, the EU referendum. And he's training his kind of frenemy Boris Johnson in the next Tory leadership stakes. I think some people have gone a step too far then and said, oh, it's over for Osborne. It's not. I think Westminster has been too bearish about Osborne's prospects, because I think in the long term, actually, his chance of succeeding Cameron are better than they at first appear.
Fraser, do you think that Tory MPs are going to continue to count against Osborne some of his failures on tax credits, for instance? Or is that really all water under the bridge by the time we get to the actual leadership contest?
Well, I mean, the depressing thing about politics is that everybody is always wondering who the next leader is going to be, especially if the Prime Minister has declared that he's going to step down. I mean, David Cameron didn't have to make this declaration, but he did. And now we all think, right, 3-4 years' time, he's off, who's going to be next? So politicians arrange themselves automatically in little tribes behind certain who they think is going to be the leader, and they always imagine tribe A versus tribe B. So you can see this, it's constantly a theme running in the back of politicians' heads. And George Osborne, of course, is the great master of 3D chess, and almost everything he does, you can see some kind of ulterior motive towards it. And his leadership, of course, I think he's made the mistake by acting a bit too much like the heir apparent. There was a stage where he was actually going abroad to meet foreign leaders and to negotiate parts of the EU deal, which is quite unbefitting a chancellor. He does things that be way beyond the remit of a chancellor. He's taken it upon himself, for example, to be the person in charge of the Hinkley Point nuclear reactor. You'll come to regret that. He's decided to be the person in charge of HS2 rail, even though that should be the transport secretary. And if I were him, I would be hanging back for a while, because you don't want to make it look like a done deal. But because he's behaving in this way, every time he slips in the banana skin, it's seen to dent his leadership chances. But I agree with James that you just cannot predict this years away. I think there's one of the things, many things in politics you can't predict, but one of the most unpredictable things is leadership contests, so I wouldn't even begin.
So he's overreached himself quite a bit, but James, do you think that he has lost support in Parliament? Because he has an impressive operation trying to build up support from Conservative MPs, much more impressive than anything Boris has managed to muster.
I still think he's got the most impressive parliamentary operation of any of the potential leadership candidates. I think he has lost some support. I think the pension changes that he considered, they really struck a nerve with Tory MPs. I mean, they because it was seen, I think it was both, frankly, seen as striking at their constituents' interests, their base, a sense that, you know, that the Tory vote was being taken for granted while, you know, people who voted Labour were being courted extensively. And I think it also, frankly, slightly struck at Tory MP's own personal financial interest, which was part of it. I think one, to pick up on something Fraser said, I think one of the fascinating things is that we all think of Osborne as this, you know, calculating political machine who doesn't do anything without having worked out what effect it will have on this leadership contest. Yet on the EU, he is advocating staying in with a kind of fervour that goes way beyond what is required to be a loyal lieutenant to the Prime Minister.
But did he have an option, really, James, do you think? Well, I mean, he was never going to advocate out of the
No, but I think he could have kept a far lower profile. It didn't have to be him who was making the calls round to Tory MPs trying to persuade them. I was struck by one Tory MP who Osborne unsuccessfully attempted to persuade to back in, who said that one of the things that struck them listening to it was that Osborne never made a careerist argument to him. And also he said that Osborne seemed to believe even his weakest arguments. You know, that he has, I think he's got, slightly got religion on the EU, to the surprise of some of his colleagues.
Well, one person who has been very quiet during this campaign so far is Theresa May. How do you rate her chances now as Tory leader?
I think it's over, to be frank. I think her conference speech had a compelling logic to it, that immigration in the hundreds of thousands makes building a cohesive society, in her words, impossible. She didn't say very difficult. She didn't say harder than it otherwise would be. She said impossible. EU immigration is running at over 200,000. She's now decided to back staying in the EU with no real changes to the freedom of movement rules. I think that is probably her...
That's a concession from her, is it, basically?
Yeah, I think that is essentially her done... barring anything happening. I think one of the things that happened is those around her were trying to push her into backing Brexit, and that was what led to the intellectual logic behind the speech. She delivered the speech without ever really intending to back Brexit, and now finds herself in a very difficult position. I think when she comes out on the campaign trail, I think she will find it quite hard to justify the shift she's made.
And Fraser, who are the other leadership contenders who you can see emerging or waning in the party at the moment?
It's very difficult to tell. The Conservative home website did a poll recently, and Liam Fox was back in the top three, somebody who hasn't been really a leadership contender for about 10 years' time. But it is very difficult to predict how things are going to go. I mean, under the Tory party rules, there are two MPs who are selected from all the other MPs to go to a vote amongst members. Now, if George Osborne is going to be one of these people, then you probably, the other person would have to be an outer. Who would the outer be? Would it be Boris Johnson? And right now, is there anything George Osborne can do to stop Boris Johnson? Is there anything you can do to try to cut off his support? So that's what it all comes down to. But there are so many variables. I mean, for example, if Britain votes out in the EU referendum, there won't be any George Osborne or any David Cameron. We're going to be in very new political terrain, and Boris Johnson would be the heir apparent.
Fraser, how do you think Boris has performed during this campaign? He didn't have a particularly good interview on the Andrew Marr show at the weekend, and he was really panned by some papers who are normally quite sympathetic to him, such as The Sun.
Yes, when I watched that Andrew Marr interview, I couldn't quite see where the great car crash was. I mean, Boris does things differently. That's the sort of politician he is. He manages to tear up the rules and, you know, get caught in zip wires and make it into a great success. And he did a version of that in his television interview. But I also think that he's been quite, his argument is improving, his line of argument is improving, and he's getting out there and he's being active. But we've got 3 months to see if he can sustain it. I think Boris has realised, as George Osborne has realised, that you can't do this by halves. If you're four in or you're four out, you've got to give it everything you've got, which is certainly what George Osborne's doing. The question is whether Boris has got the stamina and commitment to campaign for Leave with as much energy and verve as he campaigned to be London Mayor.
I think Boris has decided to really to go into this battle. Remember when he came out and did that famous kind of Islington doorstep press conference, he suggested that if the press wanted to come and ask him his views, he'd be there, but he wouldn't be doing much more than that. He's now basically doing one big intervention a week. He did Marr on Sunday. He's out stumping for Vote Leave later in the week. I think he knows he's really got to put his shoulder to the wheel. First of all, to kind of guarantee that out gets as good a result as possible, because that's his own future prospects. But he's also got to show that he is doing this out of genuine conviction. He is campaigning because he has decided that it is the best thing for Britain. And he's got to show that he can match Cameron, you know, in terms of both argument and clarity.
And finally, James, what can we expect from the budget budget next week. Are we expecting a dramatic budget from George Osborne, or, as you said at the start of this podcast, is he still going to be very safety first conscious?
I think their priority is to get through this budget without having to U-turn on anything. I think they also know, we're talking on Wednesday afternoon with this Sunday trading thing in the House of Commons, they also know that the EU referendum has had a kind of fraying effect on Tory party discipline. Once you've decided to cross the Prime Minister and the Chancellor on the biggest issue of the day, the EU referendum, it's much easier to cross them on other things. So I think they won't want, they know they've got a small majority, and they won't want to do anything that could run into trouble in the House of Commons when they have to pass the finance bill.
That was James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson. A quick reminder of our special subscription offer just for listeners of The View from 22. For just £22, you can receive a 22-week subscription to The Spectator in the post, along with access to our website, iPad, iPhone and Android apps. Sign up to read all the articles discussed in this podcast at spectator.co.uk/22. And finally, The Spectator once again returns to the topic of the Stepford students. Back in 2014, Brendan O'Neill coined the term to describe students who love to shut down debate. Soon, a website was set up, ironically called The Stepford Student, intending to show that not all students fit the stereotype. But the website has now had to close because of protests from real Stepford students outraged by tongue-in-cheek articles such as "Am I only a feminist to get laid?" which apparently showed a flippant and harmful attitude towards feminism. As Mick Hume argues in this week's magazine, politically correct students are now falling victim to the censorious climate they helped to create. I'm joined by Mick and Jack May, one of the original founders of the Stepford Student website, to discuss whether those who live by the no-platform lifestyle can perish by it too. So Mick, the student movement seems to be eating itself at the moment. What's going on?
Yes, what you have on campus, it seems, looking at it from the outside, is a kind of everybody wants to ban everybody else, censorship as cannibalism, where one group of identity activists want to censor another. So you have radical feminists who want to ban old veteran radical feminists like Jermaine Greer from campus for being transphobic. You have the NUS Black Students lobby wanting to no platform a leading anti-fascist campaigner because they say he's Islamophobic. You have someone like Peter Tatchell, the kind of doyen of LGBT campaigners, being personally no platform by the NUS LGBT officer. I think it's the logical kind of endpoint of the no platform policy that those who live by the ban can perish by it too. And once you start saying the way to deal with things you disagree with is to ban them rather than debate them, then you end up with this kind of censorship of everybody.
And what do you think is going to happen next? Have you reached a logical endpoint where actually having opinions at all is just deeply problematic and it's much easier not to say anything? Does that mean that student unions are not going to be places for debate anymore, or are you going to see a sort of revolution where you go back to them being places where people can disagree at some point?
Well, I think it needs someone to start a movement on campus for free speech and for reopening debate. Now, that is happening, I know, because some of my friends who work on Spike magazine have started the Down With Campus Censorship movement, and I've been getting a very good response on campuses. If that doesn't happen, I think what you're going to have is a situation where people are increasingly afraid to say anything because no one knows what you're allowed to say or what words you're allowed to use, and so self-censorship becomes the order of the day, and you have a much more kind of stale, an even staler atmosphere in student unions than there has been. I mean, to be honest, it was a pretty stale. They were pretty stale political places 35 years ago. When I was at university, there was only small cliques of people that were actively involved in them. I think that's going to be more and more the case.
And Jack, you are a reformed Stepford student, is that right?
I think that's what I was christened by Spectator sub-editors anyway. Essentially, I think the key misunderstanding that often happens, particularly with commentators who are coming at kind of the student movement from outside, is they mistake this for some sort of huge cross-campus thing that's going on. And, you know, as you said, Mick, everybody's no-platforming everybody else. And in reality, that's just not true at all.
Well, it's about 10 people who are doing it to each other and everyone else is getting on with their degrees.
Exactly. And in a way, the real shame is that the spaces where it's happening are the student union spaces, and those are supposedly democratic spaces. So in real life, most people aren't fussing that much about what words to use and so on most of the time. But when they're trying to get involved with student politics, they are. And as you say, people then are getting scared of getting involved. And that's a real shame because, you know, a lot of the time in the past, student unions and those kind of spaces have been really good places for people who have gone on to be great future politicians. So MPs now, like Wes Streeting, started off in the student union movement. And so it's a real shame that the vast majority of people these days feel just too scared to get involved with student unions.
So you don't think that student unions are going to breed politicians in the same way as they have previously, even for the most recent generation of MPs?
I'm not sure. I think that's still very much in the balance. I think the changes that we're seeing in student union movements are still so young that we can't really know what kind of people they're turning out. And the real kind of radicals who are at the forefront of all this no-platforming stuff, we have no idea what kind of careers they're going into. They're not really looking at things like politics in the same way. Lots of them are heading into academia. From people that I know personally, politics in the conventional sense is just not something that's on their radar at all. So I think, in a sense, but to do with student unions specifically, it is a great shame that people don't feel able to get involved with them. But in terms of universities more generally, this sort of thing is massively amplified by what we would call the mainstream media. For the most part, it doesn't come into people's lives at all. And in a sense, it's not really about no platforming for most people. For the very, again, very small number of students who are involved with platforms at all, it becomes more about intelligent platforming, which I think in a way is something that we should look on positively. It's things like presidents of the union societies of Oxford and Cambridge and Durham looking at their term cards and thinking, blimey, that's a lot of men, which I don't think is a bad thing at all. And if it takes a couple of extremists who are no platforming and banning and shutting down speech to make the vast majority of people actually look at themselves and think, are we doing the right thing? Are we inviting the right kind of people to speak? I think intelligent platforming is something that's very positive that's come out of this.
So, Mick, do you think that actually this is all completely overblown and we're getting far too worked up about a lot of people who have always been hot-headed in student politics anyway?
Well, no. I mean, the thing is, it is a small minority that's actively involved in it. I think it's one of the mistakes we often make is to imagine that somehow these young people have kind of come out of nowhere and people say, where have these tender young snowflakes come from? Actually, they're just the kind of provisional militant wing of a much wider cultural phenomenon of the kind of the culture of conformism and of whose slogan on its banners is "You can't say that," which is going right across our culture and our society. And the driving force behind that is a very small number of people who I refer to in my book, Trigger Warning, as the reverse Voltaires, the people who, unlike Voltaire, whose famous slogan invented by his biographer was, you know, "I may disagree with what you say, but I'll fight to the death for your right to say it." Theirs is, "I know I'll detest what you're going to say, and I'll fight for the end of free speech for my right to stop you saying it." Right? They're a very small number of people, and they are completely punching above their weight, usually through their favourite overrated medium, Twitter, and they are influencing public debate. And what they create is an atmosphere where other people are cowed into not wanting to say anything. And I think in the student world, it does actually affect all kinds of people that it shouldn't be. I mean, for example, social media is great for kind of circulating all the stories of what's going on in colleges on both sides of the Atlantic. It's a transatlantic phenomenon. The latest one is this story of this liberal arts college in Maine, where there's been a huge ruckus because people had a tequila party in which they wore miniature sombreros, or some of them wore miniature sombreros. Other people were seriously damaged and offended by this, apparently. And the college have now come forward and offered counselling to people who were seriously damaged by the fact that some people wore miniature sombreros. So that nonsense of that small minority of reverse Voltaires actually becomes a phenomenon on campus, where it starts influencing what people can or can't do in their social lives. You know, the rugby club can't sing their ridiculous childish songs. The University of East Anglia has banned sombreros being racist cultural appropriation. It has a wider impact, far wider impact than it ought to do, given the very small number of people who are actually driving the thing.
And how big an amplifying effect does Twitter have in all of this? There's a danger, is there not, that we all spend a lot of time on Twitter because we're journalists and we have nothing better to do, and we think that that's the real world, and actually most students probably aren't on Twitter. They might be on Facebook uploading photos of themselves, but they're not no platforming people in the virtual world.
No, Twitter is absolutely the kind of natural medium for all this, and it gives an completely exaggerated sense of the kind of volubility of the movement for no platforming and censorship, in the same way that online petitions can create a kind of the impression of a mass movement overnight, just because you get a thousand people to click on a button. So it is something you've got to take and put in perspective.
And Jack, do you think there are circumstances in which no platforming is useful, or is it just generally very unhelpful to debate in universities?
I think it would depend very much on what the platform is. And I think something like, you know, the Cambridge Union Society, whether you know platform someone in that instance, is very different to, say, for example, the example from two years ago, the debate at Christchurch, Oxford, that was all about abortion. And essentially the problem was that there were two male panelists involved. I think it was Tim Stanley and Brendan O'Neill. And essentially, the problem with that was that it was in people's living spaces.
But it wasn't. I mean, it wasn't in their bedrooms.
No, it's not.
It wasn't literally in their bedrooms, but in the sense
kitchens,
that it's
for that matter.
Essentially kind of in what is sort of a part of your house. I think you'd
it
feel
is not part. It's not a part of your house. This is the whole problem with the safe spaces thing. You know that. The woman who was behind that movement for stopping that debate, I had a debate with her in Oxford, and she was saying that it was a safety issue. We had to protect the safety and comfort of our members, and we had to protect the safety of the speakers, because anything could have happened.
What do you mean by safety?
See, I don't think it's a safety thing so much, and that's partly my
experience. So what's the problem with having it in their living quarters?
It's just sort of, you don't necessarily want it. It's not really a kind of... it's not a safety thing or something like that. It's just about kind of, if you would invite somebody into your living room, which is, to be fair, you know, say your front room of your house, it's the most public part of where you live. It's not your bedroom. You're right. But it is kind of part of your own space. And do you really want Hitler and Mussolini having a debate about children? You know, to use an extreme example.
But Tim Stanley and Brendan O'Neill are not quite Hitler.
No, exactly.
But a bit of an extrapolation.
I know, I'm going to the extreme example to try and make the point that essentially
said in relation to the debate was that people without uteruses, that was the phrase that was used, are not entitled to have an opinion about abortion. That is where you end up with identity politics.
But this is really interesting because I have people in my sitting room who I vehemently disagree with. They're my friends. Is it now the case that students cannot disagree with one another? They don't want people in their living spaces, as you said, who they just disagree with, and they can't cope with that trauma of having to argue.
An opinion that you don't like.
I think it's partly a problem that we have now with a sort of information overload. And you, on the internet, you spend all your day on the internet because it's how you work, it's how you do everything these days. And you're bombarded with all of these news outlets and Twitter and Facebook and so on. And there's all of these people's opinions shouting at you all day long. And I think that does just mean that when it comes to sort of the more private aspects of your life, people do think more and more, I'm just too tired for this. And that might be something that we should criticize and say, no, you've got to stand up. You've got to, you know, wake up and contest these opinions more actively, use your brain, etc. But I think we do have to understand at the same time that, you know, people being tired and a bit worn out by an overload of information and an overload of life.
Why don't they just go to bed?
Yeah, come off it. I mean, you know, what no platform means is no argument. Increasingly, what it means is I don't wish to discuss that with you. I don't wish to hear your opinion, and I'm going to prevent anybody else hearing it as well. Because you don't have to listen to anybody. No one has the right to be heard. But you don't have the right to stop other people hearing it and debating it and deciding for themselves.
But there are circumstances where students might not want someone on campus who is inciting violence against a group, for instance. You must have to draw a line at some point.
I mean, there is the fact of the law as well.
I am a free speech fundamentalist. I agree, and I believe in absolute free speech when it comes to expressions of opinions, ideas, jokes, insults, whatever. Incitement to violence is a very, very specific category.
What about incitement to hatred?
Well, incitement to hatred, I think that's perfect. I mean, that's that you can object to it, you can find it offensive, but it should not be a criminal offence. It's just an opinion, it's an idea. Let me give you an example of what the difference is. If I say I think there are too many ginger-headed people in this country and we'd be better off if they were all driven into the sea, that is the expression of an offensive opinion, which we could all condemn and disagree with, but it shouldn't be illegal. If I say at the end of that, and therefore you and me, let's go and get that ginger-haired bloke over there and throw him off the cliff, that's incitement to violence. Those are two very different things. It's not difficult to understand the difference, and yet the category of incitement is being continually expanded to cover more and more just opinions that you find offensive or that you don't like. A very famous judge in the American Supreme Court said 80 years ago, in the end, every idea is an incitement.
That's it for this week. Thank you to all our guests, and do join us again next week.
Gary, Winston Wolf, Direct Line. The landlord Mike says you wrecked his place.
Wait,
knocking holes in the walls. And all that graffiti? Fancy yourself an artiste?
No.
But it's all covered, Gary. Mike is with Direct Line. They'll cover up to the full amount insured for malicious damage by tenants.
Oh, good. Can I go now?
Oh, no, Gary. Direct Line's looking after Mike, but who's looking after you?
Direct Line Landlord Insurance covers up to the sum insured for malicious damage by tenants. Can your landlord insurance do that? Search Direct Line Landlord. Optional extra qualifying criteria and excess apply. Underwritten by UK Insurance Limited.